My guest tonight is James Corbett. James is the host, the editor, and webmaster of The Corbett Report, an independent listener-supported alternative news website. James is a researcher, journalist, documentarian, and perhaps one of the hardest-working members of the alternative media. He produces video reports for Global Research TV, GRTV, and BoilingFrogsPost.com. He's also an editorial writer for The International Forecaster, an email newsletter for finance. I think that was first run by the late Bob Chapman, correct?
That is correct, yes.
Yeah, great. So, James, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
And also, you're also the maker of the 9/11 conspiracy theory, a satirical look at the anomalies and discrepancies of the official 9/11 conspiracy theory, let's say. So I think that's quite a buzz when it came out a few years ago. I just want to throw that in. It's one of my favorites.
Yes. Yes. Well, it's something I've become well known for,
yeah.
Although it was the furthest thing from my mind when I was creating it that it would ever actually take off like that.
So that's always worth a mention. But tonight, what I want to talk about was a video you did 2-3 weeks ago. Meet Alan Dulles, Fascist Spymaster. It's sort of a history of the career of Alan Welsh Dulles and his brother John Foster Dulles. And the two kind of illustrated, or they're the embodiment of the kind of like the Anglo-American empire and how it dominates the planet. Alan Dulles and his brother, who were they and why were they so important?
Well, they were, I guess the way that they're best known in the American consciousness is as Secretary of State and head of Central Intelligence at, during the 1950s. That's probably what they're best known for. And Alan Dulles serving as Director of Central Intelligence up until November 29th of 1961, when he was fired by John F. Kennedy for the Bay of Pigs debacle. Although it was a very cordial firing in public, it was perhaps rancorous behind the scenes. But I think just a quick summation like that really belies or doesn't get into the depth of the amount of power that these two brothers really wielded during their time directing. As Stephen Kinzer, the biographer of the Dulles brothers in our modern age, likes to say, the overt and covert arms of American foreign policy. So they wielded a huge amount of influence at one time and were quite well-known figures during their age. And, of course, now we have Dulles Airport and things like that to commemorate them, although people don't really remember them that well anymore. But I think it's important to understand that these characters did not appear out of nowhere. They were from the political, the right political pedigree to be part of that Eastern establishment that, well, obviously looks after its own. And that was very much the case with these two brothers. They were both grandsons of John W. Foster, who was the Secretary of State under Benjamin Harrison. And Alan Dulles had an uncle by marriage, Robert Lansing, who was also a Secretary of State, him under Woodrow Wilson. So when they were young children growing up, they would often go to visit their grandparents in Washington and end up at dinner parties with Woodrow Wilson and people like this, the sort of political elite of their day. And the story goes that even at a very young age, Alan Dulles, after, you know, engaging with the adults at one of these dinner soirees, would go retire to his room and then dutifully write down everything that everyone talked about and his assessment of, you know, what they were saying, or at least that's what the legend goes. So from a very young age, very politically involved and very politically connected, and that ultimately served them well throughout their lifetime, although they spent most of their time not in the public sector, in the private sector. Alan Dulles, although he did spend some time as an American diplomat of various sorts, he was assigned to Vienna during World War I and then transferred off to Bern, Switzerland. And then he was part of the American delegation at the Paris Peace Conference. He spent some time at the Near East Division of the Department of State. So he traveled around a bit. But in 1926, he went to work with his brother at his brother's law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell. And this is a very well-embedded law company in that same Anglo-American Eastern establishment that they were part of. And they were well known for their ties to a lot of corporate business, specifically paving the way for corporations, American corporations, to influence events around the world. And so it's no surprise that after spending a good deal of time there in the 1920s, 30s, and even into the 1940s, They ultimately, once they came into power in the 1950s as Secretary of State and Director of Central Intelligence, a lot of the people who had made their sort of hit list for their corporate interests ended up getting overthrown, like in Guatemala, like in Iran, like in the Congo. Basically everywhere that there was some sort of resistance to the American corporate empire, lo and behold, America suddenly found itself either at war or in some sort of operation to oust the leader of that country. So, again, these people are two peas in a pod that came obviously from the same background and obviously were part tied into that political nexus that that really gave them their in to the establishment, and one that they obviously played to full advantage for as long as they could.
And when you say they went from private sector to government, of course, the whole nature of the system is that those lines are intentionally blurred, because you have their involvement in the Council on Foreign Relations, which traces its pedigree back to Chatham House and kind of the English imperial establishment. And that's Pratt House. And of course, Pratt is connected to Rockefeller. And we want to go how far that goes is we recently had, well, back in the 80s, we had a Secretary of State named George P. Shultz, and the P stood for Pratt. So that's where these connections go. But yeah, Sullivan Cromwell, this remarkable law firm, I was listening to one of the lectures by Stephen Kinzer, and he talks about even as early as 1917, they had the sugar intervention in Cuba. And this is where they had an election in Cuba, and the Liberal Party had won, and the Conservative Party was about to be tossed out. But the Liberal Party's platform was a land reform or a law restricting foreign ownership of property. And that's when Sullivan Cromwell told the Conservative Party just to stay in power and they'll organize things in Washington. And along came the Marines. And that, of course, that led to a 5-year occupation of Cuba by the Marines. And that's like an early example of this type of intervention that the U.S. government or would undertake throughout the 20th century on behalf of, you know, big business. So that, you know, that was even before, yes. You know, even I guess that might have been just before our entry into World War One that occurred. But yeah, it's remarkable. The Dulles brothers themselves, you opened up with talking about an interview with, I think it was John Chancellor of NBC, a very young John Chancellor, and he's talking about the Cold War and what the CIA is engaged in. I think the interview was like 1965, maybe, was it? Around that time?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. And he talks about the highest levels of power, and you asked the question, but what is the highest level of power? Stephen Kinzer, when he's talking about the Dulles brothers, he almost talks about it as these people were the apex of power. It was their personality, their background that determined policy. But he seems to avoid the question or doesn't answer for whom were they working when they were at CIA or at the State Department. They were well-paid agents, you know, for corporations. So that begs the question: what orders were they following? Who were giving
exactly
those orders?
yes, it certainly does beg that question. Yeah. And yes, the documentary that I referenced at the beginning of my Alan Dulles podcast, CIA Covert Action in Iran, Vietnam, Laos, the Congo, Cuba, and Guatemala, is the title that it goes by on YouTube. And yes, in that interview, Alan Dulles was saying that the CIA, as far as I'm aware, has never been involved in any covert operation or anything that has not been approved at the highest levels. So, of course, the question is, well, what does he mean by that? And of course, I think ostensibly that's supposed to mean the White House, the president, you know, the what we think of as, you know, the executive of branch of the U.S. government. But I think the real question is, what is that highest level? And I think it would be extremely naive, given the type of history that you're talking about with the Cuban sugar intervention or things along those lines. It would be, I think, quite naive to think that the president is really the one who's dictating the agenda here, or has been for quite some time. And I think Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles pretty well encapsulated that that idea in their own biographies, really, because as you say, I mean, their tie into Sullivan and Cromwell, it was certainly, it's not even extraordinary in terms of the CIA. The CIA was really founded by and run by for a very long time people with demonstrable links to Wall Street. Generally, a lot of people who were Wall Street lawyers were in the highest ranks of the CIA for a very long time. So I don't think that connection should be very surprising. And the implication, the obvious implication, is that American corporate power, at the very least, was one of the driving engines of the policy that they were implementing, rather than, say, the president, well, like Eisenhower, but specifically, I think, like Kennedy, who obviously ultimately kicked back at least a little bit against what Dulles was doing. So, so yes, I mean, the question is very studiously avoided by most biographers, at least mainstream biographers of the Dulles brothers, and Stephen Kinzer is no exception. As I say, he wrote a book called The Brothers, examining John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles and the sort of way they shaped American history. And he does include a lot of very important elements of the Dulles story and a lot of the ignoble actions that they undertook when they were at the helm of U.S. foreign policy. But he does frame it in that way. I think ultimately his fallback frame is, well, yes, I mean, they may have done some pretty devious things, and we don't really want to be part and parcel of that. But that's ultimately what America is. They represented America. They were good, upstanding Christian men who really believed in American exceptionalism, and they were trying to spread that through the world. And that's what motivated them, and that's what drove them to do what they did. So to the extent that there's blame to be held anywhere, it should be on all of us. We should examine, you know, how it is that America functions and what we respect and things like that, which ultimately I think really is an evading of the very real question about corporate power, about other forms of power that are wielded in Washington and how they're wielded, and especially the nature of the national security state itself, which, you know, to be fair, Kinzer even calls an invisible government, which I think is at least one step further than a lot of mainstream sources are willing to go. But the question is, if there's a visible and an invisible government, then who's the invisible president, and what chain of command do they follow, and how do those operations get approved? And that's something that's left as a big sort of unexplored element of that in a lot of mainstream biographies. I don't want to single out Kinzer, because there's been a lot of others who make similar statements, and I featured one of them in my podcast with a Council on Foreign Relations member / editor of Foreign Affairs who had similarly had a biography of Dulles back, I believe, about 15 years ago. And he was on C-SPAN saying that, you know, the CIA ultimately never did anything illegal and blah, blah, blah. So unfortunately, yes, that's kind of the part of the story that no one's really willing to dive into if they want to maintain their good journalistic careers.
Yeah. That's Kinzer was talking. He wondered with sort of, I guess, awe, or not awe, but he said, you know, the Dulles brothers in the 50s, with a wink and a nod, they could overthrow a government. And yet now they seem to be airbrushed out of history. Why have they been largely forgotten? Why are they a footnote when they wielded so much power? And when I was thinking to myself when he was talking about this, well, that's because they weren't the ultimate power. They were functionaries. And so new people have come to replace them, whether it's Kissinger or Zbigniew Brzezinski or, you know, John McCloy, and, you know, before then it was Edward Rendell House. They're forgotten, or they're sort of largely airbrushed out of history, because they're just functionaries, and they're new people now calling the shots or following orders. So that's how, you know, why they could apparently wield so much power, and all of a sudden, poof, they're gone, and yet the system still remains. So that kind of, I think, tells us what's going on here. But if you look at their careers, I think you illustrate this perfectly in your article. I mean, in your video, is here you have Dulles, who was an OSS agent. He played a key role in Operation Paperclip. So he was setting up the contours of the Cold War, bringing Nazis into the national security state after the war. He was also a Wall Street lawyer, which representing some of these largest corporations, and a founding member of the Council of Foreign Relations. I guess with the election of Eisenhower, he and his brother were enthroned at the State Department, CIA, respectively. And that kind of gives us an idea of how the system works. You know, there's a revolving door between the corporations, between government, and they all have these shared interests. And they all go to the same parties. They called it the Georgetown Set. And that was in the book by Hirsch, I think, Burton Hirsch, who wrote The Old Boys. And yes, there's a culture here, a milieu, if you will, where these people, they go to the same parties, they have the same interests, same secret societies. Let's not discount Skull and Bones and all this. Although he wasn't Skull and Bones himself, I think he was Princeton, right? So,
was he Skrull and Key? Something
he might have like been, yeah. But you know, they all kind of worked together. You know, and anyone who, I think Kinzer does an excellent job in pointing this out. kind of describing how the cultural outlook and how they may look at the world. Anyone who isn't a WASP and a part of this group, whether you're Catholic or something, you're not part of that class. You're not just another faction. You're below them, and your job is to consent to how they rule the world. And that's kind of how they looked at these things.
Yes.
But no, nothing is. He talks about the Cold War. He says the Dulles brothers were vehemently anti-Bolshevik, and they believed in capitalism, the American system, and all that may have been true. But we get into the whole notion of the Cold War. At one level, it was real. I mean, there were spies, there were agencies, there were brushfire wars, there was Korea and Vietnam. But at a meta level, much of this seemed to have been orchestrated. I think we get into, the link between Wall Street and the Bolsheviks and Thomas P. Lamont and Jacob Schiff, the National City Bank and J.P. Morgan, how they provided copious amounts of support for the Bolsheviks and during the during the Revolution, Russian Civil War, and how they went on to do business with the Bolsheviks. Do you want to get into that? What does that tell us about the real nature of the Cold War?
Well, yes, and I think one of the researchers who did really the yeoman's work on a lot of this was Anthony Sutton, who talked about the Wall Street and the rise of the Bolsheviks, or Wall Street and the rise of the Soviet Union, or I can't remember what title he put it under. But yes, that there was very much an interlinkage between a lot of these Wall Street investors and lawyers and corporations, and then the sort of the sustainment of the Bolsheviks, especially in the early 5-year plans. Basically, a lot of that was done through American manufacturing expertise, through land lease types of programs and other things of that nature, so that you got to the point where, in the Korean War, for example, it was a lot of, American designed tanks and things, the Ford tractor for tanks and things along those lines that were being produced by basically those types of programs that were then being used against the Americans in Korea. So yes, there was absolutely an element of the this being a sort of stage play. And as you say, there was a reality to it. And I think a lot of people were immersed and really playing in that reality. But I think at a very higher level, there was, if not cooperation per se, it was certainly an attempt to foster an enemy that could be used as a convenient boogeyman. And I think that's a concept that's not difficult for us to understand, especially in our day and age, when the convenient boogeyman of the Soviet Union went away in 1989, 1991, and was eclipsed eventually after a decade by the Al-Qaeda terrorist, whatever amorphous threat. I think we understand that this is the way that states function, is to always have that boogeyman that they can point to, and that's the one for our current age. And so we have to understand that the Soviets in the Cold War was very much along those same lines. And I don't know particularly if Alan Dulles was involved at that level with those types of negotiations or cooperation, but certainly I think the idea that this was some sort of imminent threat that he was valiantly protecting the country from was again a convenient excuse for so many of the operations that they wanted to pull, including something like overthrowing an Arbenz in Guatemala. I mean, basically all they had to do once they identified a target that was not in the interests of one of their corporate clients, like United Fruit for Sullivan and Cromwell. Well, if someone's nationalizing parts of the country and taking away, things that belong to our corporations, we'll just paint them as a communist. And well, we don't want this to be the next domino to fall. Can you imagine if the communists had a toehold in the Western Hemisphere other than Cuba, I guess? But so those types of things were constantly used during that period as the convenient excuse for basically any type of intervention they wanted to do. And again, I think that resonates quite well with today, where the Al-Qaeda threat or whatever, the Islamic State, whatever, branch of the terrorist threat we want to take, is always used as the convenient excuse for us to go in and bomb and destroy various parts of the globe.
And of course, even before the Cold War, and indeed, even before World War II, or at least America's entry into World War II, Dulles had been recruited by British intelligence, and he worked for the British Security Coordination, and he also worked along with the Formation OSS, which took a lot of its ideas from the Special Operation Executive, I think it was called, and
Yes.
they shared an office space at Rockefeller Center. And this is this Anglo-American, alliance here, although it's not formal. it's there. And these, whether it's the Anglophile Eastern establishment, but this goes back to even to World War One, and how the Wall Street, particularly J.P. Morgan Wall Street, had underwritten much of the Anglo-French war effort against the Central Powers, and America's entry into that war, at least one of the, I think, intrigues or reasons America was dragged into that war, was to bail out Wall Street, which was on the hook for the British-French war effort, which outside, or if America had not intervened, Germany might have won that war, or at least not been defeated. And you could see the entry into that war simply as a way to socialize the risks of Wall Street, which we've seen played out so many throughout the 20th and 21st century. That's kind of like what the Central Intelligence Agency does, or what the Pentagon does. It works
Right.
for big business and
Yes.
wraps the narrow interest of Wall Street in the American flag, and when it becomes the national interest.
And World War One was such an important inflection point in history, not only for the war itself, but what came out of it, especially as you've already noted, the creation of the Royal Institute for International Affairs and the Council on Foreign Relations, kind of twin organizations that were born out of meetings that were taking place behind the scene at that Paris Peace Conference, of which Allen Dulles was a delegate, and of course he went on to join the organization. I believe John Foster was a founding member. I believe Allen Dulles didn't officially join until the 1920s, later in the 1920s, maybe 1926 or something like that. But still, ultimately did, I think, end up becoming president of the CFR. So clearly, nexus in, and that is really a window into that nexus of the Anglo-American alliance, because again, those organizations joined at the hip had a similar structure and a similar idea, and to this day still do, which of course is ultimately going trending towards the creation of global governmental structures that will be supposedly, in their plan, ruled over by the same cliques that are at the center of these organizations. So, the Dulles brothers absolutely tie into that. And I mean, on the Morgan note with World War One, of course, the reparations, the unpayable reparations for Germany, had to be rethought out, refinanced, renegotiated on a number of occasions, including in 1929 when the Young Plan came out, which was a plan to basically chop off some of the debt that Germany owed and then refinance the rest of that debt through American banks, including, of course, J.P. Morgan. There was a group of financiers that were going to help Germany make their payments. And that led to the birth of the Bank for International Settlements, the Central Bank of Central Banks, that to this day continues to be the sort of nexus point of all the central bankers. And as Carol Quigley in Tragedy and Hope and the Anglo-American Establishment talked about, is the apex of a system of international financial control, which again goes into that heart of that Anglo-American alliance. So there's much, much deeper currents here than we are ever led to believe on the surface. And that's why I think it's particularly galling that the way that the Dulles biography is kind of glossed over, and the real influence and meaning of what they were doing is often given short shrift by people like Kinzer, who only will look at that surface level.
Yeah, I think we could only expect what is called a limited hangout when it comes to things like this, especially someone, a establishment a journalist from something as the New York Times, which is, you could say it really is a subsidiary of the Eastern establishment, the U.S. government. It poses as a paper, like the Pentagon Papers, which some people say was itself was a limited hangout and a CIA job to make the Pentagon look bad. At least that's Fletcher Prouty's analysis of that. But even talking about this sort of this cold was a false dichotomy as we entered into the 20th century, according to Norman Dodd, who was the chief investigator for the Rees Committee, he sent one Catherine Casey, who was an investigator, to look at was it the minutes of the Carnegie Foundation,
That's right,
and
yes.
she uncovered this plan that one that how to transform the nation, how to collectivize the nation, how to transform it and just bring it under their control. One way to do this was to subject the nation to constant warfare, drag the country into war, and this was like 1908. And lo and behold, in the succeeding decades, what happens?
Yes, America starts to make its turn from a fairly inward-looking country with fairly few international entanglements into the power that it is today.
And Stephen Kinzer kind of says, well, it almost treats it like a act of God or a force of nature, where these things are just inevitable. So this kind of stochastic, random events that came together, history kind of coming together, and this by accident. And he, again, he doesn't go deeper into these intrigues. If you get as you go into the Cold War, one of the more fascinating issues I've come up with is this whole Alger Hiss thing. How Alger Hiss was the scion of the establishment and all that. Then he was exposed as a communist spy. But if you look at the intrigues of the war and the shifting alliances, you know, during the war we were allies with the Soviet Union. Then all of a sudden we flip and they're the enemy, and we're incorporating Nazis who are enemies during the war into the National Security State, Operation Paperclip. People like, you know, like our Galen, the Galen Network, and all that, who, from what I understand, like formed the nucleus of the Soviet desk at the Central Intelligence Agency. But some people look at the whole Alger Hiss thing as sort of a split. There's a left-right divide within the establishment, as if that means anything. But during the war, the notion, you could say, maybe the Morgenthau leftist Hiss side versus the Dulles pro-fascist side, if for lack of a better term. And they've kind of battled out, which is one of the reasons why Hiss was exposed as a spy. Some people say that was part of a conflict, and you can see that because right after the war, what happened? We realized that we need to rebuild West Germany, and became an ally in NATO and all that stuff. And going after the Nazis wasn't quite so important
Right.
to the Dulles faction.
Yes.
So what I'm saying is, even within the elite, there are factions battling out. It's like there are factions between, you know, New York crime families.
Exactly. And they'll be happy to throw people under the bus as long as it doesn't jeopardize the entire system. I mean, as long as it's just squabbling
And
for power between different factions, that's fine. But I mean, anything that would fundamentally question the system, obviously, is never allowed.
you have someone like Richard Nixon, who his position, I think he was in the Navy during the war, uncovered Paperclip, and some people think he leveraged that information to get his political career a start. Which
Well, he did have powerful help as well. Prescott Bush, I
yeah.
believe, he was working in the office of Prescott Bush. So yes, I wouldn't at all doubt that he might have had some dirt. And of course, the missing minutes from the
Yeah.
recordings, supposedly the Bay of Pigs thing, refers to the assassination of JFK. So I'm sure Nixon had a lot of goods on a lot of people.
And if you look at Watergate close enough, that ties right back to the Kennedy assassination. That's a dimension of Watergate which isn't often talked
Yes.
about.
With the Howard Hunt and others
Yes,
take the center stage, yeah.
Again, we have here the Dulles. We have these colder intrigues, and his. So basically, the Cold War, he sets the Cold War. But of course, that happened even before Dulles came to, because you have the Korean conflict, and that's Dean Acheson in the Truman administration.
Right.
And you have Dean Acheson, his famous speech declaring Korea out of the defense perimeter of the United States. And then all of a sudden, well, lo and behold, they invade Korea. Then I think in his memoirs, Dean Acheson comes out and says, Korea saved us. What did he mean by that? Well, it created a crisis and created an excuse to kind of, because at the time the Congress was kind of hesitant with Truman's Cold War agenda. And that war created the pretext for a crisis. And all of a sudden Congress started passing the big defense bills. The money started flowing to the defense contractors. And lo and behold, you have Eisenhower's military industrial complex.
Right. And it was the first major conflict for the United Nations to flex its muscles and for the U.S. to be subordinate to UN command. And of course, the United Nations was established by people like Alger Hiss. So
Yes, and
it all goes back together.
it serves that objective of the sort of coming into UN. Of course, in the 60s and 70s, UN's kind of discredited, so they maybe have to pursue other means to achieve what they call their global government. You know,
Exactly.
so it is fascinating. But again, it's one of these things. With Kinzer, it says. So their worldviews are operational codes were identical, Kinzer writes. Deeply intimate since childhood, they turn the State Department and the CIA into a reverberating echo chamber for their shared certainties. Again, it's the psychology and personalities of these two men. And what we're suggesting here tonight is these men were working for people who were far above them. But then let's move in. So we have the fledgling National Security State spreads its wings in the 50s and takes hold and becomes powerful. And you have the incoming Kennedy administration and Dulles' conflict with Kennedy. Do you want to get into that a little bit?
Yes, well, I mean, that's such a defining point of American history in general. And of course, this goes back to the Bay of Pigs, which there all indications are that when you look at it, Alan Dulles wasn't intimately involved in the Bay of Pigs planning in the way that he had been with previous operations or things of that nature. He wasn't as hands-on, and there was a lot of meetings and planning committees and things that he was not actively serving on. And you know, it ends up being such a botched, horrible operation, and Kennedy, of course, feels absolutely stabbed in the back by this, and ultimately ends up firing Dulles as a result of it, and the egg on the face of the United States that it brings. And so Kinzer's interpretation of this is that basically by this point, Dulles was already showing the early signs of the kind of dementia and breakdown that he was going to endure in the late 1960s towards the end of his death. Basically, the idea is he was already starting to be not quite there, not all there, not in the way that he had been when he was younger and more vital. So that kind of gives him an out for that botched operation. And then, of course, in 1963, with the assassination of JFK, well, he couldn't have really been involved in that because he was already starting to go. His mind wasn't quite there, so he couldn't have been involved in planning something like that. So it's a, again, that's a convenient narrative, a convenient out for Kinzer to avoid the very big question, because of course you have Kennedy swapping out Dulles as Director of Central Intelligence in November of 1961, with John A. McCone, and then. 2 years later, Kennedy gets his head blown off in broad daylight, and who gets appointed literally within a day or two of the I think maybe the, I think it was the following day or 2 days from then, President LBJ gets on the phone to Alan Dulles to say, you know, we need to you on this this new committee we're putting together, the Warren Commission. So he ends up investigating the death of JFK. So I think that, I mean, that cannot be played. That cannot be underestimated how important that was. And I think the idea of Dulles being on the committee to investigate the assassination of JFK is such a, I mean, it's such a brazen thing to do in retrospect. You wonder if there was actually a sense that they could get away with that kind of brazenness in the 1960s, or if they just felt that they didn't even care the optics of it. I think there was a general greater trust in sort of governmental authority and public figures in that day and age, so they could kind of slip something like that through. But it's again, it's pretty galling that they would put him on the it's one of the heads of the committee that ultimately saw, well, nothing really to see here. No big problem with the death of JFK.
And of course, the suspicions of Dulles being involved in Kennedy's assassination are based on the fact that Dulles himself had set up under Operation, I guess it was Mongoose,
Mongoose, yeah.
and under
Operation 40.
Ed Lansdale. He ran that, but that was kind of an umbrella project. But within that project, included the recruitment of assassins from organized crime, Corsicans, mobsters from the United States, because these were the mechanics who could pull it off. And from the standpoint of the agency, they could maybe, if they wanted to get Castro, well, Mongoose was the plan to overthrow the Castro regime, including assassination, necessarily, and a lot of other dirty tricks and terrorist actions within Cuba itself. But if Castro were assassinated, they could pin it on the mob and say, well, he had a lot of enemies in the mob too, because he had nationalized, their casinos and their brothels and all that stuff. So the mob had a good reason to overthrow the Castro regime as well. But what it did was it set up the system, or it set up this relationship with the CIA and the mob. Of course, the National Security State had a long history of involving itself with organized crime. You have the Luciano Project during World War
Yes.
II. So this goes, much further back. But this is why people look at people like Dulles, and not only the fact that the motive he had would have been revenge, and also the fact that Kennedy himself, although not a perfect man, very flawed in many ways, and had signed off in a lot of many on many national security misadventures in his presidency, same with his brother Bobby, had moved to weaken the CIA. In fact, it reportedly said he wanted to break into 1,000 pieces and cast it to the wind. But he had clashed with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the CIA over the Bay of Pigs and over the Cuban Missile Crisis, and there was a sense that Kennedy needed to be taken out, because he, in his own, I don't know if Kennedy knew it or not, but Kennedy was taking on the very powers that brought these agencies into existence.
And he didn't
Yeah.
sign off on the Joint Chiefs of Staff Operation Northwoods in 1962 for committing terror attacks and blaming it on Cuba. So yeah,
Yes.
a lot of different things that I mean, yes, I agree. I
Yeah.
think Kennedy is perhaps too lionized, and I think he definitely did have a lot of faults and was part of that establishment, certainly, but there were certain lines that he didn't cross, and I think that ultimately played a part in his death. But specifically with Dulles's role on the Warren Commission, I mean, there are certain things that we can point to, including the very first meeting of the Warren Commission in December of 1963. You have Alan Dulles passing out a book that he says it will predict the outcome of their investigation, basically that it was a lone gunman. And he goes on to say that to John McCloy, he goes to say there was so, I mean, one man was so involved in this plot that it almost wasn't a plot, basically, that it was just the lone gunman was already decided by Dulles, apparently, in December of 63 and the very, very first meeting of the Warren Commission. So he had that narrative all ready to go. And of course, he also, in a 1964 executive session of the Warren Commission, ordered the destruction of a transcript to do with Lee Harvey Oswald being a paid FBI informant and other pieces of the puzzle. So there are specific things we can point to with regards to Dulles and his contributions to the investigation of JFK's death.
You could say he Dulles was sort of the Philip Zelikow of the Warren Commission.
That's a good theory. I don't know to the extent that that holds, because Zelikow, I think, well, infamously, I hope at this point, wrote an entire outline for the 9/11 Commission report, including chapters and headings and subheadings and sub-subheadings, before the report was even written. So that was completely dictated from the get-go. I think Dulles was certainly there to be that wall between the CIA and the Warren Commission to filter out any information that was uncomfortable to the agency, and I'm sure he performed that role very well.
But yeah, he was it was a strange thing to put the man who had been fired by Kennedy on the commission to investigate the president's murder by Johnson. Chris Johnson, I've read Russ Baker's book on the Bush family, Family of Secrets, that listening to the tapes, Johnson had threatened Earl Warren.
Yes.
So he had something on Earl Warren, something that occurred in Mexico, I think. And Earl Warren almost breaks down and cries. He didn't want to be on the commission. He's sort of threatened to be on. So he had to be threatened to go on the commission, blackmailed
Yes.
more or less. So that kind of gives you the idea of how that commission was controlled from the get go. Also, the fact that it refused to hear certain witnesses. I think Jack Ruby wanted to testify before it, and they refused to listen to him. Of course, Jack Ruby died shortly thereafter of fast acting cancer. But he, of course, Jack Ruby himself, the killer of Lee Harvey Oswald, claimed that it was a much wider conspiracy.
Yes, and the public will never know the truth. Something along those lines. And
Something
yes, he
like
ends up dying of cancer in jail. Yeah.
that.
Yes, absolutely. But I mean, so this so much swirling around the JFK assassination. I mean, it's so fascinating, and I'm sure we could talk for the entire time just about the Warren Commission itself. But I think it does provide a window into the types of operations that the CIA was admittedly and demonstrably involved with, as you say, with Operation Mongoose and the hiring of these assassins to assassinate foreign leaders, and the implication being that that plot came home to roost. But I think that gives us at least a window into the types of operations that the CIA was engaged in and actively engaged in during the time of Dulles's tenure as well. And some of those operations are now part of the public record. I mean, we now know obviously about Operation Ajax. It was actually finally officially confirmed, although the documents have been out on it for I think something like a decade and a half now, or it's been quite a while. But I think it was officially finally acknowledged by President Obama just a couple of years ago, and to overthrow the Mossadegh in Iran, that is, and Operation PB Success to overthrow our friends in Guatemala. Things of that nature are fairly well known, and of course we also have operations and programs like MK Ultra and mind control experimentation and the types of horrors that, again, we do know now that were committed in the name of at least attempting to get this type of mind control ideas and technologies. And to the extent that they were successful or not in that program, it was officially scrapped anyway. But those are the types of things that have surfaced in decades since Dulles passed away to show what he was working on during his tenure. And again, we're only scratching the surface. I mean, I think there must be operations and things that that obviously we just have no way into, but at least gives us an indication of the type of power that Dulles really did wield. And again, the real question is, well, then who was he wielding it for?
And of course, the pretext for MKUltra was the Korean War. And of course, we have the Manchurian
The
Candidate.
Manchurian Candidate, yes.
Interesting thing about the Manchurian Candidate is you have that novel, Richard Condon's novel, 1959, of course, the movie a few years later, that was produced by Frank Sinatra, is they reveal MKUltra before MKUltra was revealed to the public, at least one aspect of it, the mind control assassin. That's sort of predictive programming there.
Yes, there's a lot of interesting coincidences surrounding that book and the author and his connection to the Kennedys, in fact. And then ultimately, of course, that movie gets thrown into the memory hole after the assassination of JFK, and it's only years and years later that it's finally shown again in the United States. So, yeah, it's a fascinating
It
history just
is.
behind that book, and I think there's definitely the indication that Robert Condon knew something about something. I don't know how he knew that, but it's fascinating to look at.
The another well, little side note, you mentioned the Warren Commission report and get your take on it is one of the I guess one of the critics of the Warren report was on the Kitchen was Haley Boggs, the congressman from Louisiana, I think.
Right.
Well, he died in a plane crash in I believe over Alaska somewhere, and you know who picked him up to drive him to the airport to get on his doomed flight?
I really don't know.
William Jefferson Clinton.
What are the odds of that?
Like I said, I don't know what that means, but it's certainly
Yeah,
interesting.
it is interesting. There are a lot of interesting little connections
How
like
about
that that
this?
you.
The frequency of the name Harvey has to do comes up with in terms of presidential assassinations. I mean, you have what? You have Lee Harvey Oswald, of course.
Right.
William Harvey was the head of the assassination unit that Dulles picked
Right.
on Goose. You have Lawrence Harvey, who was in the Manchurian Candidate, and there was a guy named Harvey in 1979 who was allegedly involved in an assassination plot against Jimmy Carter that was thwarted.
I never even knew about that
Yeah.
one. That's interesting.
He claimed that apparently, and he was recruited by a guy named Oswaldo Ortiz, one of three Latino men he described, and the police initially disregarded as a ravings of a madman, this guy Harvey.
Yeah.
But they investigated, and they did find that this guy named Oswaldo was checked into a hotel where the near where the president was speaking. And the plan was to have him fire off a starter pistol as a diversion so they could shoot the president.
Interesting.
And
It's interesting what plots actually
yeah.
succeed and what ones don't.
Well,
And
they could also just be threats against the president.
exactly.
Like the
Yeah.
rumor that when a president gets inaugurated, they take him into a room, they show him,
Right. Yeah.
some film, some different perspective of the candidates. So say, now here's our agenda. That's you don't know if that's apocryphal or not, but
No. But I mean, you look at something like Reagan in 81, and he's never the same man again, according to people who knew him.
Well,
And then it became the George H.W. Bush presidency, really. I mean, for the
because he took over the NSC, and that was the Iran-Contra,
Yes,
which was
exactly.
much bigger than people. I mean, it was than let on. It wasn't about the Contras. It's about so much more.
Yes.
But yeah, you have the intro, how Bush got nudged his way onto the ticket. Apparently, the Reagan campaign was very upset about it, because at the time Reagan was kind of campaigning against trilateralism and CFR stuff and all that stuff. Whether or not he was genuine about it or not, who's to say? Apparently, they got a call or a meeting with Henry Kissinger, and said, "Do this or else."
Right.
And that's how politics is played. Of course, the fact that Reagan was shot by the son of a good friend of the vice president might be some indication.
Yes, who was actually scheduled
Pinky
for to have a dinner meeting
with Neil Bush.
with Neil Bush, yeah, and I think that evening or the
The
next
day
evening.
next day or something.
Yeah.
But all that is very interesting, to say the least. Apparently he was obsessed with Jodie Foster, another lone nut, I
Yes.
guess, right?
Yes, exactly.
So here we are. But again, getting into this into the whole thing with Dulles, because it really because you have the when it came, we got moved into the 60s with the Dulles brothers. Of course, his brother John Foster died in 1959 of cancer. And you have Dulles perched in over there at Langley, and of course, he as you mentioned, he was fired after the Bay of Pigs. But the policies didn't change because, you still had 1973, you have the coup in Chile, and Dulles is long dead, 4 years, I think,
Oh,
at
of
that point.
course, yeah.
And it's
Yeah,
very
exactly.
similar. It's very similar. And at the
Yes,
time,
yes.
Richard Helms was the DCI, but you have the
That's right.
same interests and all that stuff.
And Kissinger, of course, up to his eyeballs in that.
Yes. And Kissinger
Yes,
was.
I think we saw the passing of a baton, not necessarily to the DCI. I think in the early days, I think the secret government was really quite more overtly organized, so that the DCI position itself was, I think, a position of power. But I think that did change in the 1970s, 80s. We saw the people in sort of the background in the National Security Council and positions of that sort that really took the driver's seat when it came to a lot of these operations. And obviously in coordination, and I'm sure none of these operations really happen without the knowledge of the DCI, but I don't think that the power necessarily flows from that position in the way that it did during Dulles's time.
Yes, one thing I want to get back to is you mentioned MK Ultra and LSD, and one of the plans or objectives or policy or programs under MK Ultra was the experimenting of LSD, well, with the public in general. We saw that with the 60s and the George Hunter White, and he was the narcotics agent, who really the CIA agent who was operating safe houses in San Francisco and testing people. But it turns out the CIA was very big in spreading LSD throughout the United States, particularly at these rock concerts, these Dionysian festivals, where all
Yes.
the stuff was promoted. And this seemed to be a broader cultural agenda that people like Dave McGowan and Jan Ervin have exposed, with the Magic Mushroom and Life Magazine, the Time Life Empire, promoting drug use in
Right.
their articles and all that, not to mention the creation of the counterculture, which was largely manipulated. I think the
The
evidence is
Grateful Dead and the
Grateful
electric, the
Dead
late
and
acid test
the
and all that.
Hitchcock Mellon Mansion and Timothy
Mm-hmm.
Leary. But I'm reading Doug Valentine's book, The Strength of the Wolf, about the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, and it gets into all these intrigues with the Kennedy assassination and MK Ultra and
Yes.
all that.
Yeah.
Because basically, is the FBI could investigate drugs, but they were always frustrated because the moment they got higher up, they ran into CIA operations.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So they're always shut down at that level. But he was here's one angle that he alludes to, which I never haven't really considered. You're familiar with Janney's book about Mary Meyer.
Yes, I haven't read it,
And
but
Peter
yes,
Janney's
I'm,
book, and
yeah.
the story there is, of course, the affair with Meyer and Kennedy, and he was one.
Right,
And they had a real relationship as opposed to some of Kennedy's other conquests.
yeah, flings,
Yeah.
yeah.
So, but apparently, they came from the same elite pedigree, although he's Irish, I think she's WASP. But they had met when they were younger, and there's this beautiful woman who's divorced because of, Cord Meyer. Cord Meyer kind of became possessed with the necessary state, kind of broke up their marriage and all that stuff. So, but one of the stories is that Mary Meyer gave the president LSD.
Ah, I haven't heard that one.
Yeah, and this had some effect on. Now, she's very well connected. She knew Timothy Leary. Timothy Leary gave her the LSD.
Right.
Timothy Leary is connected to MK Ultra.
Yep.
Doug Valentine, I think, alludes to in the book. He doesn't come out and say it, but he says that one of the programs was to give LSD to leaders and see what would happen. That's part of the MK one of the MK Ultra test programs.
Maybe it was actually done. That's an
Yeah,
intriguing
and
hypothesis.
that's maybe why she was, of course, then. Her friendship with James Angleton. She was very good friends with James Angleton's wife and Red Bradley, another member of the Fourth Estate taking on in the establishment. He was a CIA asset as well. The Washington Post, of course, the Meyer thing, but of course, then she's murdered. I think less than a year, 11 months after Kennedy's assassinated on the canal pathway in Washington D.C., and that's never been solved, by the way. I can't help but think, but maybe Mary Meyer herself, who's at least Peter Janney portrays as some sort of this visionary artist and free thinker who's influenced the president to turn towards peace. Maybe herself, maybe she was unwitting. Maybe she was an agent of MK Ultra.
You really don't know when you start uncovering and
Exactly.
unpacking these operations, because one of the things that these operations are designed to do is to throw smoke at every possible turn, so that there's usually several layers of these types of cutouts. And the more that I look into events like these, like, for example, I've spent a fair amount of time looking at the Oklahoma City bombing and Timothy McVeigh and his role in that and the FBI and the ATF and what was going on in that. And the more that you look into it, the more you realize that it's very possible that at any given point of an operation like that, there are people who don't really know what's going on. They only know the little part of the operation that they're working on. And then, you know, there's other things going on above them that they may start to figure out at some point, but may not have actually access to directly. So they're trying to piece it together in the way that we are from the outside. So I really do think that's the way, obviously, intelligence operations are structured. That's something that that Alan Dulles himself obviously knew very well. He was one of the people that really formally solidified the statecraft aspects of intelligence. And in fact, he wrote that book, The Craft of Intelligence, talking about the history of intelligence operations and how they're performed. So it's something that he obviously thought about deeply and did, I'm sure, in various ways perfect during his tenure at the CIA and, of course, in the OSS and his other roles besides. So I think that's something to keep in mind, is that there's usually no ultimate resolution to things like this. We are sort of backing into so many of these operations with obviously imperfect knowledge, and even the imperfect knowledge that we get often is from sources that themselves may have been used by in one form or another by the intelligence, and it, you know, there can be cutouts behind cutouts. So it can be extremely frustrating for researchers, but I think that the overall picture is actually quite easy to see. I mean, we can see the people and the groups that benefited from things like Operation Ajax or PB Success or things of that nature. That's quite easy to see. So in a certain sense, that higher level of power that Dulles talked about is quite visible. It's not unfathomable. And some of the finer details of these operations obviously are difficult, if not impossible, to piece together. But I think we understand what they're going for, generally speaking. And I think that gives us something of an advantage. I mean, for people who are willing to simply go where the facts are leading rather than to come up with convoluted theories as to why, you know, the Dulles brothers may have been pretty bad people, but they're ultimately reflective of the American character or whatever kind of, you know, easy cop-out we want to use. For people who are just willing to look at the facts squarely, it's not so impossible to really put together that picture of the invisible government and at least why it's doing what it does, if not precisely how it's doing what it does.
Well, James, you summed up the interview perfectly there, and I know you have an interview at the top of the hour, so I'm going to let you go to catch your breath and get a sip of water before the next interview. I want to thank you for coming on tonight. All I can say is you got to go to the Corbett Report. It's corbettreport.com. He does have a paid listener list there, so you can sign on and support his work there. It's very important that you support work of people like James and other websites, because it's the only way this information gets out there. You certainly can't rely on the corporate media. I always say it's incumbent on people to cancel their cable service and divert the money to supporting outfits like yours. So,
well, I do appreciate that. This work really is made possible by my subscribers, and they don't get a lot out of it in terms of secret access to information. All of my work is freely available. I have a subscriber newsletter, but even that editorial is freely available on the International Forecaster website. So really, it is. I just encourage people to look at the archives. I have thousands of hours of audio and video now at this point. And if you do appreciate the work and want to see it continue, please do consider subscribing. It really does make a difference.
And with Abenomics, the yen is lighter than ever, so it's cheaper for Americans.
It's true. There's been a very big difference over the last few years. Yeah.
So, there you go. Abenomics. So, okay, listen. James, thank you for coming on tonight. And perhaps in the near future, we can do it again if you have the time. I know you're busy, so I won't pester you, but I'll send it out.
Well, I really appreciate it. This was a very, very in-depth interview. I really appreciate you having me on, and I'm looking forward to doing it again.
Thank you, and good night.
All right. Take care.